What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
The EU races to finalize a price cap on Russian oil. Plus, the constant attacks on Ukraine's energy system do not appear to be breaking the will of the Ukrainian people.
They feel like staying and continuing to try to make the economy work in Ukraine is how they're going to help the war effort.
And Twitter once again suspends Kanye West. It is Friday, December 2nd. I'm Peter Granitz with The Wall Street Journal, filling in for Luke Vargas. And here's the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. The European Union is trying to finalize a plan capping the price it would pay for Russian oil at $60 per barrel. The plan is set to go into effect on Monday. It needs unanimous buy-in from the 27-country bloc. Thus far, Poland has not committed. After that, the plan needs to be signed off by the G7. As the journal's Lawrence Norman says, the goal of the cap is to punish Russia while inflicting as little damage as possible to other economies.
What the price cap is aimed to do is to ensure that there is enough flow of oil and Russian oil on the international market, preventing oil prices spiking when the EU introduces on Monday its own embargo on Russian oil.
President Joe Biden says South Carolina should be the first state in the Democratic nominating process. That is according to Democrats who've been briefed on a plan to shake up the early primary states. The people said that Biden would like for New Hampshire, Nevada, Georgia, and Michigan to follow. Those are typical battleground states in the general election. The move would take away clout from Iowa and its caucuses, which have gone first for 5 decades. It would also reward South Carolina, which helped revitalize Biden's 2020 campaign during the primaries. If a Democratic National Committee panel meeting today recommends the change, it would need to be approved by the entire DNC next year. 4 Chinese solar manufacturers skirted U.S. tariffs by routing some operations through 4 Southeast Asian countries. That is expected to be detailed in a Commerce Department investigation set to be released today, according to people familiar with the probe. The findings are likely to speed up the race to find alternative sources of parts for solar panels. The investigation began in March and led to uncertainty about imports, causing the cancellation of solar projects across the country. When the investigation began, a spokesperson for the Chinese Foreign Ministry said that Beijing would take all necessary measures to uphold the rights and interests of Chinese companies, and that U.S. protectionism would disrupt and undermine global supply chains. Twitter has once again suspended Kanye West. The musician and designer on Thursday tweeted an image of a swastika merged with the Star of David. New Twitter owner Elon Musk said on the site that West again violated our rule against incitement to violence. West was suspended in October for an anti-Semitic tweet. Twitter did not immediately respond to a request for comment on how long West's suspension would last. West could not immediately be reached for comment. Shares in Blackstone dropped nearly 10% Thursday after the company said one of its real estate funds would limit redemptions. The Blackstone Real Estate Income Trust said requested withdrawals in October exceeded its monthly limit of 2% of its net asset value and its quarterly threshold of 5%. The Income Trust has been one of Blackstone's biggest growth engines in recent years. It invests in, among other things, rental units in the Sun Belt. A company spokesperson said the fund is well-positioned for the future. And looking forward today, the U.S. Labor Department is set to release the November jobs report. The unemployment rate in October rose to 3.7%, a slight increase from the previous month's half-century low of 3.5%. A weak yen would normally be good news for export-focused Japan, but normal times these are not. The yen has lost 15% against the dollar this year, and that has forced many U.S.-based investors to pull out of Japanese markets. For more, we are joined by Heard on the Street columnist Jackie Wong. He is in Sydney. Welcome.
Hi.
Jackie, what's been the effect of the low yen on the Japanese stock markets?
The Japanese stock markets have actually, in yen term, they have been doing quite well. I mean, they are flat this year, but given the global market have been going down everywhere, so they have been doing pretty well. I mean, S&P is down around 14%, so that outperformed them. But the problem is the yen, they had lost around 15% this year. So for US-based investors, they basically offset all the outperformance they may get from investing in the Japanese market because the yen, they will have lost money on the yen, even though the market itself would have outperformed.
Usually when a local currency is down, big exporting companies like that, right? And I'm thinking of the Hondas and the Toyotas of the world. How are they taking this?
They're doing okay, but then they have revised up their profit forecast. But some of the effect of export that one would expect from a lower yen is a bit mixed because many of these manufacturers, they have moved their production facilities outside of the country. Say automakers, many of them, they have their own production plants in the US to be closer to their customers. So in that sense, it doesn't benefit that much. But because they have a lot of overseas income and that translates into yen, I mean, that would be a higher profit for them in yen terms too.
So are things looking up?
Things are looking up, but on the other hand, there's also a issue of higher raw material cost, especially given this year, like energy and many commodities prices have been surging. So that kind of hurt them on the cost side. So it kind of makes the blessing for them.
That is Jackie Wong. He writes The Herd on the Street column. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up, months of Russian attacks on Ukraine's energy grid have left millions of people without power and repair crews racing to get it back on. Now Russia's foreign minister has a new justification for the strikes: to stop Western weapons from flowing into Ukraine. That's after the break.
You're a growing business and you can't afford to slow down. If anything, you could probably use a few more hours in the day. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Russian attacks on Ukraine's energy system have left millions of people without power, and the country is only getting colder. Some of the outages are from direct hits on power stations. Others are from regulated blackouts because energy companies are trying to ration the limited supply on a weakened grid. And now, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says the strikes are justified because they could prevent the U.S. and NATO from getting weapons into Ukraine. Joining us now is Ian Lovett. He's a reporter covering Ukraine for us. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Can you help me understand Lavrov's justification? Hitting civilian power supply will prevent Western weapons from entering the war.
Unfortunately, I'm not sure I really can help you understand the thinking behind that. Even when the power is out, the roads are still working relatively well, which is how those weapons are getting in, mostly from Poland, we think. So I'm not sure what the logic is in terms of saying that taking out the electric grid will stop Western weapons from coming in. The conventional wisdom among military analysts that I've spoken to is that the goal of hitting these power stations is sort of twofold. One, it's to make life difficult for civilians in the country so that they will put pressure on Ukraine's political leaders to get to the bargaining table and end the war on terms that might be more favorable to Russia. And two, to put pressure on the West, because they're hoping that, A, there will be a stream of refugees leaving Ukraine again, as there was in the spring, and B, that Ukraine will need more aid just to help people stay alive in the country, and that the West will get fed up with all they're being asked to offer.
Just to stay alive in the country. Well, paint a picture of the country for us right now. How big of an issue is the power outage across Ukraine?
There's been a really dramatic change all across the country since this wave of missile strikes started about 2 months ago. In September, life in Kyiv felt quite normal. The curfew was back, I think, to 11. Most of the block posts that in the spring were all over the city had been abandoned, and restaurants were open. People were going to bars. Most of the population had come back. We're estimating that there were probably about 3 million people in the Kyiv metro area. Now, the electric supply is incredibly limited. There were several days last week when the city was totally without electricity, and then it started to come back, but at first it was just 2 or 3 hours at a time. And so obviously this has had a huge effect on life there. In a lot of places, the water system is also connected to the power system. So when the power goes out, the water goes out. And I can tell you from personal experience, that's actually much tougher to deal with. I was in Kherson the last couple of weeks, and the Russians had just pulled out a few weeks earlier. And so there was no water, no heat, no power, because those are all connected to the power system. And really, the water was the issue. People were lining up to get drinking water. You need water to flush the toilet. You need water to take a shower. And so getting by without power is comparatively easy compared to the water issue.
Well, what does Ukraine say about these attacks on both the electric system, but also the water system?
Ukraine's argument is generally that Russia's trying to make life unbearable for the civilians. They're asking the West for more help with air defense systems so that these attacks won't be as effective in terms of knocking out the power grid. But they're also saying that the population is not going to be cowed by these attacks, that people are determined to continue to fight until they've pushed Russians entirely off Ukrainian territory. And at least from my anecdotal experience, I think that's largely true. You know, in the spring, we saw this huge wave of people fleeing Kyiv and other major cities. And certainly there are some people leaving, particularly the more recently liberated territories. But I think they're mostly staying in Ukraine. And in Kyiv, I haven't really seen a ton of evidence of people leaving at all. They feel like staying and continuing to try to make the economy work in Ukraine is how they're going to help the war effort.
Well, the US, the EU, and others have pledged help for Ukraine's energy system. Will it be enough to get through the winter?
We'll see. I do think that Ukraine will be able to weather this winter. It will be difficult and unpleasant, but, you know, as long as there are enough generators so that people can come and get warm, and as long as there is a supply of fresh water, these issues are mostly not life-threatening. It's just a quality of life issue where it's difficult and unpleasant to be without power for most of the day, without cell service, which is also often connected to the power grid. But the cell service and the electricity are not threatening anyone's life.
That is Ian Lovett. He's a reporter who's been covering the Ukraine war. He's in Berlin right now. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
And finally, dating in the time of inflation. The average date in the United States now costs $98, according to dating app Zoosk, forcing some daters to show potential matches their frugal side. Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Wolf explains how high prices in the pandemic may have shifted dating culture for good.
I do think frugal dating is the new normal. I think that pre-screening your dating app matches with a phone or video call is here to stay. They don't want to go on a date with a stranger anymore. And they certainly don't want to spend $100 on a stranger. So one of my sources told me that she now almost exclusively goes on walks around Prospect Park in Brooklyn with her dates. And she loves it because it's something she tries to do every day anyway. It brings her joy, even if she's alone. And so even if it's not a match, they can both feel good at the end of the date, having spent their time in nature and spent $0.
You can hear more about Rachel's story, complete with tales of asking your date for a Venmo payment the day after, in today's Your Money Briefing podcast. And that is What's News for Friday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Peter Granitz with The Wall Street Journal. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening.
What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.